On today's Roadman Cycling Podcast, I chat with the mad scientist of strength, Chris Duffin. Let's cue that intro.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Roadman, welcome back to another Roadman Cycling Podcast. On today's interview, I'm going to chat with Chris Duffin. If you follow him on Instagram or you're into strength training, Chris Duffin is known as the mad scientist of strength. And you just need to look at a picture of Chris to know both why he's called the mad scientist and why he's called the mad scientist of strength. He is impressive physically and sports a sort of a bit of an Albert Einstein look about him if Albert Einstein was absolutely shredded out of this world beyond belief. I think the easiest way for me to explain who Chris is to read just a couple of lines from the back of his book, which I actually just finished reading and is highly enjoyable. The book is called The Eagle and the Dragon. Whatever has happened to you, it's not who you are. The world may know you as Chris Duffin, the mad scientist of strength, but you wouldn't have guessed it if you saw a scrawny kid skinning rattlesnakes and chasing dragonflies in the early 80s. The story of unconventional life will take you from gripping tales of murder, trauma, heartbreak, and survival deep in the Pacific Northwest wilderness, all the way to the idolization of self-made man, still flawed, but never broken. This dude it's an insane story. Growing up homeless, witnessing all this, as it says there, murder, trauma, heartbreak, but being an avid book geek and a reader, and really an amazing story of never letting your circumstances define you and thriving in spite of. I think this is a powerful interview because you get that out of it, no matter how bad your current circumstances are, to not let those circumstances limit you and strive beyond them and have a vision for your life that's bigger than your circumstances. But secondly, Chris is the founder of one of the biggest strength and conditioning equipment companies in the world, Kabuki Strength. So he speaks with authority from an engineering standpoint and from a biomechanical standpoint on the benefits of strength training and what sort of strength training you should be integrating into your day. It's a fascinating interview and he's a fascinating dude. I'm going to jump into it in 1 second, but a prompt before that to check out Patreon. If you're enjoying the podcast, you're loving these interviews I'm bringing you with guys like Chris Duffin. Where would you have ever found someone like Chris Duffin if I hadn't have brought you this interview? It's just, I'm digging deep and I'm finding some pearls of wisdom out there, folks. But it is research and there is resources going in the background to bring you this podcast 5 days a week. And I'm able to do that because there's an amazing group of people out there who listen to the podcast but also choose to support the podcast. And they support it by going over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. Takes 2 seconds and they buy me the price of a pint of beer once a month over there. And that's what keeps the podcast rolling, folks. So if you can't afford it, not a problem at all. This content is brought to you 100% free. But if you can't afford it, please think about supporting the podcast. Roadman, without further ado, I welcome to the Roadman Cycling Podcast, the mad scientist of strength, Chris Duffin.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to some good conversation this morning.
Chris, I feel like all of us are not one version of ourselves. We wear many different hats and we're different things to different people. And even at different stages of our life, we've been a completely different person. But when I look at your story, it's the wildest fucking story I can remember reading about in a long time. So
that's probably why I've got a best-selling autobiography and a movie that's going to be released kind of based on that pretty soon. So it's not like horrible, worse, you know, it's not like, you know, trying to one-up stories, but the scope that I've covered in my life is definitely outside the norm, the scope of it anyway.
I, preparing for this podcast, I literally could have got a dartboard and threw darts at topics and started the conversation on any of those topics, and it would have been such a cool interview still. But I want to start at early life, because you had such a non-traditional upbringing, background, parentage. Talk to me about your upbringing and give listeners a little bit of an insight into what life was like in those early years.
Yeah. So for the most part, I grew up homeless in the wilderness. And that may sound like a little bit of an overstatement maybe, but it's the reality of it. My mother decided that she did not want to be part of society. She dropped out of school where she was going to school to be a chemical engineer and moved up into a homestead in the mountains with another family. And then we spent a few years out there and then shifted kind of to more deeper remote areas. So this is, you know, living in areas where, you know, this is Northern California, by the way. So there's rattlesnakes, there's bears. And like, I remember a time we had to have these beams, we'd lash them up in the trees because, you know, I was 6 years old and we'd have to climb up there and sleep at night because there's so many rattlesnakes. And I was being taught how to capture and handle live rattlesnakes at 6 years old because that's the environment I lived in. And during the school year, you know, summers were definitely spent in that environment. During the school year, we'd move closer to town sometimes. And so we may be living in a home, but oftentimes it was, you know, a condemned home, or it didn't have running water, didn't have electricity, didn't have either of those, or it was a tent, a trailer. That was the basis of our lifestyle. My parents, I mentioned Northern California. So this is in the early 80s. And in that time period, there was some massive weed growing going on in the area. It was like the go-to place, Humboldt County. And we were actually a little bit deeper in more remote. There's actually a docuseries on Netflix about Murder Mountain. We're about 50 miles from there, even deeper, more remote.
Nice. So sounds like a nice spot.
When I tell stories and you read my book and you hear things about corrupt police, serial killers, human trafficking, murderers, like that is what I lived in. And it affected, every one of those affected our family. And so I've dealt with all aspects of that. So it was pretty wild. We got taken in. Eventually, we got end up as children. I've got one younger brother and three younger sisters. I was the oldest, and I was the one kind of taking care of the kids while they were out tending crops or cutting firewood. And then we got taken in by the state, spent about a year in foster care. And then parents got out of the drug trade and kind of restarted life in the central and eastern Oregon. They got into, quickly kind of fell back into, you know, those types of habits of being away from society. So this time it was, you know, researching geology and then getting into prospecting and mining. So that's,
but just to,
that's cut, one interesting
to cut,
thing.
It, cut it there for 1 second, Chris, and to intersect. When I think about homeless, and I'm sure for a lot of our listeners, when you think about homeless, There's two types of homeless that are now really in society. There's elective homeless and there's no choice homeless. Like, we're seeing a culture of people, you know, hipsters starting to live in vans, live, you know, in makeshift dwellings because they've risen to a certain education level where they're making conscious choices to say, I'm not going to be enslaved by the normal confines of society. It seems like very early for your parents to make that choice, but listening to your story, your parents were super well educated. It doesn't seem like they were falling into the, oh my God, we actually can't afford a house space.
Yeah. So so this is coming out of, you know, the early 70s, you know, out of the 60s, where, you know, a lot of that hippie beatnik type mentality was. And so my parents were from the area just north of San Francisco, Santa Rosa, Sonoma. It's kind of known for wine and stuff like that today. And yeah, it was definitely influence on them as far as that. So very early adopters of that. And so like that, it's funny because now I see things coming into trend that I was dealt with as a child, like around food choices. Like, you know, this is late 70s, early 80s, and it's like you only get your food from the co-op. Everything's organically grown, and like all this stuff that is like now you start seeing filter into the general populace was happening in at that time period you know, 50, 40 years ago. Right?
But isn't that such a wild shift? I'm seeing that as well, where like I didn't grow up super wealthy, nothing like the circumstances that you grew up, but we would have bought our fish straight from the boats. And just that was a financial necessity. We had to go and buy the fish straight off the trawler before the shops added their margin and markup and it became unaffordable for us. But now it's such a cool hipster thing to do. Oh my God, straight from the farm to the fork.
Yep. So, and then, yeah, as far as education, yeah, my father was a member of Mensa. My mother was, you know, top of her graduating class, big, you know, 1500 person high school for academics and athletics, which, interesting enough, I got the same exact award when I graduated high school too. And we read nonstop. So we didn't have access. A lot of people like, oh, did you look up to, you know, sports stars or movie stars? I'm like, I didn't have any of that. I had books. We would go to the library, you know, every few months and just get giant stacks of books and be up at night reading that by candlelight or flashlight. And that's what we did. And so, like, that's how we got into that, the trade of, you know, prospecting and mining, is just started researching geology and understanding what's going on. And that's, it's a unique thing. So it was definitely a bit of choice, but when you make that choice, then you're in the hard times and you can't just like switch this, you know, flip a switch to get out. And along with that was also the, you know, 'cause we're a family that size living on $5,000 a year.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking dirt poor. Like, I got, you know, toes sticking out the side of my shoes. I'm being made fun of because I haven't bathed, because don't have access to it. You know, if it's, you know, I might heat up some water on a stove and step out the back door of the cabin and, you know, try to wash over my head.
Yeah,
you know,
it's no. It's easy for listeners to kind of glamorize what that sort of lifestyle is like. But the reality is, these are very formative years for kids. And I remember kids in school getting picked on because they dressed slightly different to other kids. And they're coming from largely identical backgrounds. And you're dealing with, you know, some of the high level stuff you mentioned, like homicide, drug trafficking, these sort of serious crimes. How impactful were they on your early upbringing?
Yeah, so that is like something that I like to spend a little time on, because people do romanticize that. They go, oh, that must have been so amazing. I'd love to live that way. And they don't realize that not everybody that lives in that environment is there for the same altruistic reasons, right? And so this is where you find out, oh, hey, the guy that's camped a half mile away that my stepfather's been drinking with every night, tied somebody to a tree and beat him to death with a tire iron because he owed him $20.
Yeah.
It's how we got caught up with a serial killer tracking the family. It's,
well, hold on, wait. Tell me about that one. What the fuck?
It's also tied to the human pedophile or trafficking ring as well. That stuff is a little hard for me to get into in conversation, because it's fairly emotional. So I just kind of leave that to my book on those ends. But let's just not go there this morning.
So on a broad question on all that stuff,
how did it affect me?
Yeah.
I had nearly every single type of trauma affect me and definitely my siblings. And that was, as well as like you were talking about, like people making fun of you for clothes and things like that. Like, that happened to me on a regular basis, changing schools all the time. So I was a child with a lot of self-esteem issues. I think that would probably be the biggest, a lot of self-esteem issues as a result of it, and just started facing depression very early in my life.
Did you have an awareness that it was depression, or because I never understood what depression was? Like, I don't know what age I had an awareness of this, but definitely not as a teenager that I even knew this existed.
So I did have awareness of it because my father, it runs in the family. So every person on that side of the family has killed themselves. And my father attempted it 6 or 7 times, once in front of me. And And so I watched him deal with that his entire life. And he wasn't there with, like, I would go visit him, you know, just a couple weeks out of every year, but it's, you know, you could see it. And so I was familiar with that. I knew it ran in the family as well. I didn't really think about the connection to me as much. I just knew what I was going through. And that is kind of what got me turned into the athletic endeavors. Like my time. So it was like, I found that it was really useful for my mental state when I was out in the mountains and I'd be, you know, just, you know, packing the rocks up the hill from the mining claim, out hiking for endless, when I was in school, going to the track at night and running until I couldn't run anymore. And then I started getting into weightlifting and I was maybe 11, 12 years old. It was around 1988. And that was, to me, it was both the social aspect as well, because that started affecting my self-esteem and building my confidence. I had a lot of confidence around my abilities already. So being able, you know, having to like work and forge, you know, your area that you live in and the things in life, like I had a lot of time, which leads to a lot of successes in my ability to figure out how to overcome obstacles. And so I had a lot of confidence in myself, but it was the social side of it. And I was the nerd, you know, I was the straight A student. And so I decided to, one, I enjoyed that physical aspect. And that was something like my mother and father always pushed as well. Mother and stepfather, strong back, strong mind. Because we were a very physical family. We did physical work all the time, right? And
but looking back now, so, Chris, you're a father now, and looking at the difficult upbringing you had, is it hard to imagine your kids growing up in that type of environment?
Yes. And that was actually the impetus for writing my book. And that's when I really started processing what had happened in my life. So up to that point, I didn't really talk. People didn't know anything about my life, really. And it was when I started, and they started getting 4 or 5 years old, 6 years old, and I'm looking at my children and I'm going, holy shit, they're the age that I was when these things were happening to me. And that is just insane. And I think how I got through that and continued is that survivor mentality. I was the one who was taking care of my siblings while they were, you know, out working, tending the crops, cutting wood. And then later in life, after I graduated high school and started going to college, things got way worse. I ended up taking custody of my three younger sisters. And I raised all of them while I worked on my engineering degree, my MBA, and was working on my career full time as well. And so I never had a chance. I think I did it maybe on purpose. I don't know. But I didn't have a chance. Like I said, I could feel the depression. I could feel the other things, but I always had to be present. I had no fallback plan. There was nowhere to go. And I had to be there for other people, not myself. So I couldn't fail. Right. So I never addressed it until I'm like, I'm getting in my mid 30s and then in my late 30s with my kids. And I'm like, it started hitting me and I'm like, whoa. And that's when I started really processing it, was at that point. And yeah, it was an eye-opening experience for me.
But isn't the crazy thing, and I think about some of my friends and the super interesting lives they've had, hard lives, but interesting lives, and almost the harder the life, the more interesting the dude. Like, we're going to get on to, you know, how you pivoted your life. It just became this incredible success, in case listeners just think, holy shit, this is the most depressing podcast I've ever heard. It's an actual, it's a really good, heartwarming story. But a lot of this hardship laid the foundation for that story. And do you look at your kids and worry and go, this generation just have it, they have it too easy. They don't have the hard back to create the hard mind.
So that's a very good question. And it's a tightrope to walk that, because there's two sides to that coin. This generation, yes. Am I worried for my kids? No, because I learned some lessons, some important things, and that's what I try to pass along. And you don't have to go through trauma to achieve that. But you certainly can lay the foundation. The problem is when you're exposed to that level, it's just like, well, I need to think of some cycling analogies, but you don't just go out and, you know, do a hundred miler, you know, your first time out, right? But everybody's got a different base level of resilience. Some people, they can barely do anything when they start. Other people can, so your baseline's way higher. And the same thing was your ability to tolerate all types of stress. So everyone's got different emotional capacities, mental capacities to process this stuff. And so the same thing that I could withstand at a baseline, a lot of other people can't. And that's where, you know, I grew up around people. Where are they? They're dead. They're on drugs, living in the mountains. They're in prison. And then there's me. And then there's what I did to help my sisters. Now, but without stress, without adaptation, there is no life. And I am not overspeaking here. This is, so go back to training, specific adaptation to imposed demand. Like, if you don't use it, you don't lose it. If you don't have that resistance, there's literally nothing for life force to push against. Like the trees out my windows, if there's no wind buffeting against them, there's no elements beating them down, they're going to grow to a certain height and they'll just fall over because nothing tells them to grow those roots deep and strong.
So you take right? the same principle that we would hold true as endurance athletes of, you know, stress the body, you know, then you acclimate to that and then you re-stress it. You take that approach, not in the physical, in the mental.
Well, it's the same physiology. So this is like, if you don't have it, you get soft. You could have been one hard motherfucker back in the day, and then you took it easy for 20 years, something happens in your life and you're like, you're not prepared to handle it, right? So you've got to, and then you can improve. I said, everybody has a different baseline. Well, everybody can get to where they can do a 100 miler, right?
So do you think you have to
develop it? So what I can withstand now, I couldn't withstand earlier, right? So it's like, you have that big workout in front of you, you're afraid of it. You're like, man, I don't know. And then you get done with it and you're like, fuck, I did that. How about, I can do that again. And you know what? I can handle a little bit more. And this is why you need to learn to turn into those things, but you also learn to need to fail, and you need to fail. This is part of the process.
So what
can I do for my kids?
So you broke free of all the, you know, what society would say were limitations. You know, we always look at people in certain demographics and society puts a ceiling on what you can achieve. And it's a very rare outlier that breaks through that imaginary ceiling that society imposes on people. If you're from a certain demographic or certain low socioeconomic background, you know, you can't go on and be a doctor. You can't go on and be an entrepreneur. You can't go on and be a lawyer. You broke free of all that. You ripped up the rule book. How did you get this mindset where the bad experiences you had never defined your outcome?
Yeah. And it's not me just like speaking out and saying it like words. I have two tattoos on my body.
I've seen them. They're kick ass.
The eagle and the dragon. And the eagle I had done when I was 19, 20 years old. And it starts at my ankle and comes up my leg and covers my stomach and my back. It's 40 hours of work. And I had that done at that time period of my life because I wanted to express that you could fly to whatever heights that you want in the world. The only thing holding you back at the end of the day is yourself. So there's a chain on each of those eagles around their foot, and it wraps down around my body and it's shackled to my ankle. And it's that realization that you're not defined by your environment. You are defined by your actions and responses to those things, because you sit there and you ask people who they are, and you're going to all the time, you'll hear somebody define themselves. I am this person because of my alcoholic parents. I am this way because I'm the guy with a bad back. I am like all these things that they don't have control over. And that's not the definition of yourself. The definition of yourself, and the beauty of this, and it's freeing, is you're responsible for your actions. You're responsible for how you respond to things. And we see a lot of this like stoicism coming.
I was about to say it's very Marcus Aurelius stoic philosophy.
Yeah, I wasn't reading that stuff at the time. You know, I'd have conversations with people, and they're like, "You're a stoic," and I'm like, "I don't know. This is just my views on life." And
well, I love that Marcus Aurelius has one. We don't define our future, but we define our habits, and our habits define our future.
So I've read all that stuff. Well, not all of it, but I've read a lot of that in recent years. You know, the verbiage and stuff that I go through is all, this is all mine from 20 plus years ago. And
lived experiences are always so much deeper though, aren't they? They're so, yeah. You can't, like, it's the same in bike racing. I can talk to you about the nuances of a bike race, but I can never get into your heart and into your soul what it's like to be at maximum heart rate, to be just holding on for dear life in a bike race. You have to live that.
Let's save that conversation for just a bit, because I want to finish this one. The other side is like failing, and I want my kids to fail. And what's the best thing that I could do as a parent? I jokingly say this, like when your kid reaches that 9-month period of time, which is if you have an understanding of developmental kinesiology, they're moving into the starting to stand and walk phase, kick their feet out from under them. And it's this tongue in cheek, but it's not. What do people want to do? They want to grab their hands and hold and make sure and teach them, get them walking as soon as possible. But that teaches the child and the nervous system within the child to rely on other things for support. And so we actually have a breakdown. We have an elevation of the rib. I don't need to get into all that the side of it, but it actually ends up causing pain and struggle later in life because the body is reaching, you know, trying to find stability in another range when it actually needed time developing resilience and being able to stand up over and over and over again and ingrain the patterns over and over and over again. So yeah, I needed to kick the feet out from under them.
I love
because
that.
Because that's more opportunity. That's how we learn and that's how we grow. And then it's the understanding, you know, this simple analogy here, but guess what? You fall down, you try again, you try again. You climb up on the side of the couch, you take a step, you fall down, you try again. And you find out I can overcome. And that's the opportunity that I had in my life is I had so much around me. That's where I said I developed so much confidence in myself that I knew I could overcome any situation because I had failed so often and come to understand that's part of the process. That's part of how you learn to overcome. And so when you've got your child, you know, as a parent, and let's move past the 9-month period of time and they're like, hey, let's get ready for college. And you're holding their hands. We've got to hire this tutor. We're going to have the best person help and prep you with this. And we're going to have, and it's like, let me fill out the paperwork. We're going to do the college applications for you. We're going to make sure I'm going to be a great parent. I'm going to get you into the best school. And I'm going to help get connections to make sure you get a good job, a good internship. You never fucking learn life. You never, and you see this sometimes with like professional athletes or college athletes that are gifted and they never had the chance to overcome injury, to overcome obstacle. Everything was handed to them. And then it's like, oh, they're going to be the next greatest. And then something happens and they disappear.
Well, I often feel this about entrepreneurship as well. And it's something that, you know, later in life you gravitated towards. People always say to me, oh, you know, it must be amazing working for yourself. It's like, there's no safety net. There's no one at the end of the month going, oh, here's your re-up. You got another $5,000 this month. Well done. It's like, you don't get the head down. You don't grind. You don't pay the bills. There's no conversation with the electric company going, I didn't quite close any sales this month. The new podcast sponsor didn't come true. It's like the safety net's not there. And you behave different and you grow up faster without a safety net.
And so I had that as well, right? And so it's these type of things that you can think about employing as a parent. And so that's why I wanted to spend a great bit of time on this because, yes, if you've had a struggle environment growing up, sometimes it puts you in an environment that you innately just learn this stuff, but it also may be too much. And that baseline level of resilience wasn't enough to start building on. And what happens if I start doing, you know, 100 milers twice a day, 7 days a week?
Just crocked, injured, sick,
you
mentally
get fucking
broken.
Crushed, yeah. Right? So this, the whole other entrepreneur, like it's all the hustle. It's the grind. You got to push yourself, get through, you know, there'll be time to sleep when you're dead or when you get through this is fucking hogwash, and it's bad and unhealthy, right? So that's balance and context to this stuff. So when you actually have a training background and you can relate this, so this is why I use a lot of training analogies with this, because you're like, oh yeah, fucking I know that. It's the same physiology. I mean, this is proven. I'm not making this stuff up. And so when you start clicking, you're like, oh yeah, yeah, it makes sense, right? So we've got to have context. You got to rest and recover. Now, you know, hey, taking a weekend off, maybe every now and again, you take a week off and you freaking don't do anything and you feel great coming back, right? But what happens if you take 3 months off?
You're dumb. You can't move the next day.
And that's my point. And then as an entrepreneur and as a person in life, now, if you start thinking about what's the practical nature of this? When we're talking about this, it could be your opportunities for training are in front of you all the time. Your opportunities are right in front of you and you don't even realize it. You're running away from it because your gut is twisting up in a little knot and you're going, that makes me a little scared. That's actually your signal. And let's say you're not an entrepreneur. You're just in a corporate environment and the boss has got a big project and you're like, man, duck my head. I don't know if I can do that. I'm gonna hope he picks somebody else. You're like, that'd be kind of exciting, but I don't know if I can do it. Raise your hand, right? Could be the choice to become an entrepreneur. Like you've got this nagging idea, but it scares you. Going back to school, making a career change. You know what? Could be a difficult conversation with your partner. Could be a difficult conversation with your mother. Could be like all the times in business, that hard conversation with a boss or a coworker that you're like, something came up. You're like, I'm just going to avoid it and see if that problem goes away.
So Chris, I love
step
that.
Step into it. That's your workout, man.
It's really the obstacle is the way stuff. It's like whatever you're fearing, where you need to go. That's showing you the path.
Yep.
So you've reinvented yourself so many times and we could literally do a 6-hour podcast and we wouldn't run out of things to talk about here. So you've reinvented yourself from, you know, the early traumatic childhood we talked about. I'm glossing over some of the stuff here for listeners, but definitely go and check out Chris's Instagram, like Mad Scientist of Strength, which is just complete fire. But you reinvented yourself into the corporate world and then you have everything that at one point in your life, I'm assuming you wanted. You have security, you have a path for financial freedom, and you walk away from all that. Like, what the fuck is going on in your head?
So anyway, I went to school for a dual engineering degree, got an MBA. I was working the whole time. And of course, this kid with social problems growing up decides, what am I going to do for a living? I'm going to go into leadership, like the word, right? And part for the reasons that we're talking about, right? It challenged me and I ended up doing really well. And next thing you know, I had advanced to a level where I was a sought after corporate exec they'd hire to come in and turn around a company. They'd hire me in like a general manager role, director of operations, whatever. I turn around a company. I turn around a division of company. I'd take a company and grow it from a regional to national to international. My biggest one there, I took a supplier for Boeing that was on the verge of losing its contracts, had about 150 employees that were all going to be let go. And I turned it around from, they weren't meeting standards for Boeing for delivery or quality, and they weren't financially successful as well. And over the course of 4 years, I turned them around to be the highest performer in the world for quality and delivery in their segment, made them financially successful, and then walked it through the sale process. So that's the type of stuff that I did.
And I can tell you're still proud of it.
I was doing that in my early mid-30s, that is not what you get to do at that time. I'm dealing with corporate execs. I'm dealing with banks. I'm flying out trying to broker deals. Like, this is pretty legit stuff at that level in that type of industry, right? that's most something people would never even get to do in their life at pinnacle, you know, like in their 50s. And so, yeah, I'm proud of that. Right. And success story after success story. Got a house with a white picket fence. I've got two kids. I found a woman that I got married to. It was a nice, comfortable relationship. I had my projects in my shop. I build vehicles from the ground up, suspension design and steering design and all sorts of stuff. So I've got a machine shop at home, like I had everything. And I'm sitting there stabbing myself in the eye every day. Like, why am I unhappy? And I realized I tried to show to the world that this kid from the sticks could be successful. I could do everything that was supposed to be done to show that I'd made it through and I'd created the American dream. But I woke up one day and I realized it wasn't my dream. I realized I needed to make change. Oh, also, as a competitive athlete, I'd been ranked number one in the world for 8 years straight as a powerlifter. Had some all-time records, things like that. I think I even had a couple Guinness World Records at that time, too, from some events that I'd done. So, like, yeah, I was doing fucking good.
I listened to, I recently had Brian Keane on the podcast. I know you were on Brian Keane's podcast a while back as well. But Brian spoke about this analogy, which I loved, and I just think it's so applicable here. At a time in his life, he said he spent so many years climbing a ladder, and then he got to the top of the ladder and he realized the ladder was leaning against the wrong wall.
Yes, exactly. Now, I did see some great things. So at that point, I really started diving deeper in this introspective process that I've had my whole life. I kind of walk people through in my book, The Eagle and the Dragon. But I had to ask some deeper questions, like what was I missing? Because I loved helping people accomplish more than they thought possible. And for me, the corporate turnarounds, I could care less. I was an expert in lean methodologies and this and that, like all this stuff. It's around changing people. You change people, you change companies. And I challenged people just the way that we talk about here. I got them doing things. I got them actually leaving my company at times because their dream was something else and they would see success and then finally make the move and I would support them in that endeavor. And so I got that out of it. I got a lot of, I'm highly competitive. So the successes, I'm proud of them, right?
So Chris, what I want to do is with the next step of your journey, what I actually want to do is, because I know so many listening to the podcast right now identify with everything you're saying up to this point, and they're in a comfortable position in work, they're in a comfortable position in life, but they know there's more out there for them. Like, talk to me about, as you're telling this next story and you're starting to build, you know, your fitness, what I can only really describe as a fitness empire nearly at this stage, as you're starting to build this out, like, what are the goal setting techniques you use and how are you visualizing success? And, you know, how can people do that themselves right now?
So this is a simple five whys process, right? It is asking yourself why you want the things that you want over and over again. Spending a month like on each one or a week or whatever you want, but it's not a quick, it's not a Sunday afternoon project. And why do you want the career that you want? Why do you want the physical things that you want in life? And the goal is to get to these things that you can't have. Like, I want a fancy house and a fancy car. Why? You may get down the road and find out, oh, if I have those things, actually the underlying thing that I really wanted was security. I wanted to know that I was in a position that my family I didn't have to worry about my family ever being in the environment that I grew up in, right? I want to have continuous challenge in my life, okay? That's actually the opposite of security. There's balancing, but it can be another value. It is for me is be continual learning. For me, competition, this aspect of challenging myself and finding my limits through touching the edges of what I'm capable of. And so I started digging in. This is one of the approaches. And what I found missing in there was my creative expression was one. My other was really building a sense of community and family built around my values and the impact on the world. And this will make more sense in just a second. So the other thing that I really believe in is very counter to anything that everybody will hear you, but like, how do you find balance in life? Moderation. Fuck that. That's what I say. This is actually my process to, again, help find your values and your path in life is take some things that you know are absolute must-haves, right? And that are crazy and oftentimes maybe diametrically opposed and chase those to the extreme. I want you to find balance through chasing the extremes. So squat. I want you to have absolutely perfect squat form, for example. This is not a life values thing. I'm just an analogy. Absolutely 100% people are like, oh, I better start with body weight or just a bar. It's like, needs to be perfect. And the others, I want you to put every fucking last ounce of effort in this. I want to chase it to the people like, oh, it's forms to the wind and whatever. But I want you to do both. And you're not going to find the defects in your form or where you're breaking down until you start pushing the maximum. You're not going to be able to reach the maximum until you find and chase every last potential energy leak and so on. And the beauty is you can find something in the middle that's amazing. So for me, squat, I squatted 1,001 pounds.
I seen that. It was insane.
I deadlifted 1,002 pounds for 3 repetitions. I'm the only person in history that's ever done a squat and a deadlift for 1,000 pounds to demonstrate that I'm not a specialist, that I have the ultimate ability to handle spinal mechanics, my philosophy around movement and biomechanics. This is walking the walk, getting to a point. So in my life, kids are getting older. Family is so important to me, sense of family. I have my lifting, my expression through that. I've got my vehicle builds, my engineering stuff that I'm doing. I've got my home relationship with my wife. I've got my work. I'm like, something has to give if I'm going to keep pushing this stuff to the ultimate. What's going to go? So I quit my job. It's the least important in it. So I could chase those others, right? And that was when I founded Kabuki Strength, because then that allowed me to do what? To integrate like the creative expression in what I was doing, to create the time that my work was actually still involved training so that it could become part, not an add-on of what I was doing in life. And it would work with that. It would allow me to chase those things that I was doing to the utmost by actually designing the equipment to be able to make it happen so I could move better, feel better, the things that I wanted to have happen, the development of the methodologies, clinical and so on, that all work together. It had to go. And so, balance through extremes. Again, I work harder than I ever work in my life right now. Yet I've created more time for my family. I would say an average of 4 hours more a day for my family.
Well, so how are you doing that? When I look at your Instagram,
how is that?
Yeah, that's what when I look at your Instagram or anyone looks at your Instagram, they're going to be like, you've more hours in the day than me. That's what people are thinking right now. They're like, how are you doing all this?
They look at it and they go, everybody wants to know, like, do you only sleep a couple hours a day? What's your time management philosophy? I suck at time management. I'm fucking horrible in my sleep. I got almost three hours of deep sleep, 2 hours of REM sleep last night, in bed for 9 hours with 8 hours of sleep. It's right here on my phone. Anyway, it's about alignment. So everything that I'm talking about here and understanding your values and chasing the balance through the extremes is about getting those values aligned with your life, because people, you have to start with values, then figure out now what are your goals to help you have a life that'll realize those values. That means that every step that you're putting forward each day is moving towards this place, this thing. You're never going to get there, but you're always closer than the day before. Where a traditional life is you've got all these other things, and you're like, you may go for 6 months, 6 years, even longer, with never actually moving a place that means something real in life for you. And so if you can get those aligned, you can do amazing things. And so I've aligned that in my work. I've attracted these people that now are my community, right? I have, like, within my, everything is all part of the one. So when people ask me, like, what my job is to be me.
I love that. It's something I'm living right now. It's like, my background is a lawyer, and I'm working full time as a podcaster and a cycling coach, and trying to find that alignment with, what would I do all day for free? And now let's see, can I make money from doing what I would do for free, and seeing how it can help other areas of my life grow.
So in the course of this, real quick, you know, it was 2014 when I started making these changes, 2015. I walked away from that career. I was paid really well, sought after. I leveraged my entire retirement. I had a couple homes. I sold those, moved into an apartment. I left my wife as well. Managed that relationship with our children very, very at the forefront of that, and actually improved the quality of that. And then over the next few years, what did I do? Well, I thought I was just going to be a single dad, but by creating who I am in the world, it drew amazing people. And I found an amazing woman at 40 years old, found love for the first time in my life, which is, that was fucking a wake up call. And I'm like, oh, the stuff in books and movies, that shit's real. Nobody told me that. And and yeah, within a matter of years, like right now, we work with 90% of all professional sports teams in North America, 90% of the NFL, 90% of the NBA, 29 of 30 major league baseball teams, every major college that you could think of, 600 plus more, action movie stars like The Rock, Thor, so on, Marvel Studios. We just did an install of a unit right off of the Oval Office for our commander in chief, you know, to help get him a little more resilient and healthy as well. Every branch of the military, like, that's pretty freaking impressive, right?
But was that the vision? Did you set out to create that and then you've been moving towards it? Or has that just been stuff that's come along?
I set out to scale what I was doing. I set out to scale what I was doing because I have a unique lens in what I've been able to see. And it's not just the storyline of my life. I actually would like to dive into that here in a second. And I knew that I could help the world be better in a way. I knew that I could help the world in development of resilience, while at the same time reducing pain, reducing injury, and enhancing the quality of life. And I want to change the face of fitness all the way through with this integration with clinical care. And that's what I'm on a mission to do. And I have, so my lens, probably can't see some of the stuff behind me, but I, from an engineering standpoint, right, I've got a very different eye. I talked about what I've done there, but at the same time as having that clinical back, or sorry, the same time I have this background in engineering, I started doing clinical continuing ed around 2010 and developing relationships with some of the best physical therapists, chiropractors, spine biomechanists in the world, developmental kinesiologists, so on. I can list off names if your audience is in that realm, they'll recognize a lot of these names. They're the best of the best. They write the books that go into the schools. And I lecture alongside them. That's really interesting for someone that's an engineering background, right? But then I have the sport, I'm walking the walk. And this is the thing I wanted to talk on earlier. Where you said you can read all the research you want, but you learn in the doing. You don't know what it's like until you feel something yourself, right? So I've got this included in my lens as this, as a performance athlete at the highest level in the strength training environment, in the recovery, how to recover from some of the most damaging things that can happen you know, having to learn to walk again, being in a, you know, moving into a walker, dealing with, you know, And so this lens that I have is significantly different than most anyone else. So I've got awards now on our products. I've got awards from Oregon Institute of Technology for scientific innovation. I've got awards for the products in the industry. I've got, some Guinness World Records there. You know, it's just this really interesting mix of stuff that creates this lens about how we move and how we load and how we can improve the biomechanics related to that, so that we can improve the level of adaptation and remove the stressors that we don't adapt to. So it all pulls back to these really base level thought processes from the 80s and 90s that I was learning around the mind to how we employ those in the body. And so that is what I'm trying to do today. So did I have all of it spelled out? Not necessarily, but I knew what it felt like. I knew what it was. And it was a mixture of tools and education and a continuum of care that included the clinical interface and how that all meets in and the recovery processes and supplementation and all of this. And so so that's what I do today, is creating all these things in a fashion that I can bring to market and then work on scaling that.
One thing I'm fascinated, Chris, with high performers, I'm fascinated about habits and routines. Because as we talked about earlier, you know, we don't define our future, but we define our habits. Do you have a set number of habits each day that you're like, this is my non-negotiables? I have to train my mind in this fashion. I have to train my body in this fashion. And I have to nurture my soul and my spirit in this fashion. Or is it more ad hoc?
Mine is definitely ad hoc. At the same time, I do that by nature, but I'm not great at actually planning that. So I do have massive ADHD and bipolar as well, which you can understand runs in the family there. But it creates this is where actually discovered I'm more of an artist than an engineer. And which makes sense now, because I'm like, in college and beyond, everybody's like, it doesn't make sense how you operate. You know, how can you just like walk out and create like an entire machine or a vehicle from like your mind without all the prints and planning? And I'm like, well, I have it. It's all right here.
It's like beautiful mind stuff.
It's just how I work. It's not beautiful mind. Like we all see and work in different ways with what we are. So it's, people aren't necessarily smarter than one person or another, but what I can see is a connection in very diverse areas that most people can't see. I can see the connection between, you know, that vehicle suspension design and what I'm doing with my rehab therapy and what's happening. You know, it like all these like pieces, you see these common themes and pieces and start pulling it together. And that's why I work in so many different realms. You know, I do podcasts top level for, you know, mental health. I was on Lex Friedman's podcast. I've got Andrew Huberman supposed to come up and visit. He's the lead neuroscientist for Stanford.
He's good. I like that podcast.
I play in a lot of realms because what I do touches on all these. I see these connection points, and that's what I'm good with. So I could sit here and try to think through some of my routines, but it is a little bit ad hoc. Like the finding the time to train and move every day is absolutely, you know, essential for me to have my time with my wife, to spend like an hour every day talking about the future together, all the different variants and plans and, you know, potential ideas, so that we can create this shared vision of what we live together, and that we know, like, it is huge for me.
And what is the future? What does the future look like?
What's that?
What does the future look like for you?
Let me finish my last thought. So I have to have time for my creative expression too. So like I may go work on my vehicle for like 3 days straight every now and again, but then I may not touch it for a while. But it's like, I know these things and I go down those routes. What does the future look like for me? Well, it looks like the edges of the tree, like every individual branch and leaf and so on. There's a million different iterants and, you know, it's constantly moving up it. I think to set and go, that one particular leaf at the end of that tree that I'm looking at is where I'm going to be. And my vision is to create that, to make that happen, is too specific. And that's where you need to keep in mind this value proposition and the way that you want to live your life. And you start there, that's the trunk of the tree. Okay. And now we start creating the goals and how we express that. And we start moving up and finding that refinement. It's like, oh man, I see myself being a surgeon because that my interest in the human body and all this, whatever it is. And then you go down there and then your hands get crushed. Is your life over? No. If you understand the values, you can go, oh, I can shift over here. You know that. And so, but the future for me, that plan, I could walk through it. I'm not going to, because the world's not ready for it. Everything that I release all fits together. And some of my products I delayed for the market to be ready for, but the integration of all this together and how we move forward with that, it'll just sound way out there. And so there's just no need into diving into it. But, I would like to create an integrated, cohesive system, and then scale that across the globe. And right now, I'm inventing the equipment that doesn't exist to be able to pull that off, and creating the processes around being able to look at what's going on in the body, as well as the neurological inputs and how we manage that, and the programming around it, and how all that works together again with the cohesion of care between coach and client and clinician and all those pieces. So
any more strength stuff on the horizon? Any more going for any more world records? Any crazy lifting records?
Absolutely no. I set out on what I called the grand goals in 2015. I did, which was to squat and deadlift 1,000 pounds. So when I talk about not being able to tell things at that time, I just said I was going to deadlift 1,000 pounds. I didn't say I was going to do it for reps, because if I said that, people would have been like, you're freaking crazy, you're stupid. And if I'd said I was also going to squat it, been like, no fucking way. If I said I was going to squat it for reps, no fucking way, right? So in 2016, I did the deadlift. I continued to do these crazy feats all built around that. But then in 2019, I said I was going to squat 1,000 pounds. And it's got closer to 2020. People realized I definitely had the strength to it. And I had to just say, okay, the goal is to do it for reps. And that when I do that, I'm done. I'm done with lifting heavy. And there's been a lot of challenge, you know, during that and post going, well, you'll go back to it. You can't get away from it. You'll be drawn to it because of your nature. And I said, no, that's it. I'm done. And it means training is still a focus in my life, but that training has shifted from pushing that extreme area to prove my methodologies and also the self-discovery process of that to how does it enhance the health, longevity of my life. And so it's a very big shift. I've lost over 50 pounds since then. And I have not done anything in that realm at all. My people are like, but how? Well, I understand what my values are. And so that lifting heavy and the things that I was doing there are one way of expressing those values. What I just touched on about the future and what I'm trying to create is my next grand goal. And that's what I'm chasing right now. So just because I did that for so long as one expression doesn't mean it's the only way that I can express those goals. And this is important for people to hear, because you never know when your ability to do things in your life can be taken from you. And look at a lot of professional athletes. When they get done and they retire, not all, but many of them fall into depression, alcoholism, drug addiction, because they use that to define themselves. I am this. Not realizing that was one way of expressing the things that were central to them, and they can take that and shift to another realm. And so this is a really important message, and I'm demonstrating it. I went from doing something that no one thought was possible, has not been duplicated, and I just stopped. I did it. I walked out of that phase on my terms. I said what I was going to do, and I did it. And then I'm taking those things that I use to drive me to do that and shifting that focus to do some other amazing things.
Chris, that was an interesting chat. It was an amazing chat. The Eagle and the Dragon is such a brilliant book, and I highly recommend anyone out there who is looking for an insight into just overcoming and reinventing and reimagining what the possibilities of life can be to go and pick up a copy. Chris, thank you very much for joining me on the Roadman Cycling Podcast. It's been a pleasure. Roadmen, thank you for listening to today's episode of the Roadman Cycling Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm asked all the time how listeners can support the podcast. Well, there's a number of ways you can support the podcast. As I mentioned at the outset, Patreon is an easy way to support it. But if you don't feel like subscribing on Patreon, or you can't afford to subscribe on Patreon, a really easy way to support the podcast is simply sharing it with a friend. Take the episode link and sharing it into WhatsApp groups, into club Facebook groups, and just helping to spread the Roadman word. You can follow me, and you can find me over on Instagram. Our handle on Instagram, it's roadman.cycling, or we have a new TikTok account where we're taking extracts from the podcast and posting them over there on Roadman Cycling Podcast is the handle there. Really, for all things Roadman Cycling, the Mission Control is our main website, which is newly launched, and that's on roadmancycling.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. They make such a huge difference. Or if you're not on Apple, you can leave the review anywhere where you listen to the podcast. Roadmen, have a great day and ride safe.